Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. The Trump administration has cut thousands of research grants, and the impact on scientists has been substantial. We'll hear how some are still trying to do their work amid the uncertainty. We'll also talk with a professor about artificial intelligence and how it may be used in education. A man who spent more than 30 years in an Illinois prison for a crime he did not commit is now free, and he'll talk with us about the ordeal and his life today. Several years ago, Chicago officials made a deal that brought some short-term financial gain. Looking back, most say it was a mistake. We'll have that story. We'll preview the race for Illinois' 13th congressional district with primaries on both the Democratic and Republican sides. We'll also hear about a new Illinois law that ensures students won't be denied education based on their immigration status. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It's been a year since President Trump came back into office, and for many scientists, it's been a year of major changes and uncertainty. The administration has cut grants, jobs, and targeted particular subjects. Harvest Public Media's Kate Grumke spoke with scientists throughout the central U.S. to understand the impacts.
A pontoon boat loaded with scientific equipment motors across a small lake lined with homes in central Missouri. Scientist Rebecca North is having her perfect day.
I love being out in the field, and we don't get to go out as much as we like.
It's a warm day for winter, but still cold enough that the boat has to break through ice to get to the first test site. North and her team are here to get an overall idea of the health of this private lake. She does this type of work a lot as an associate professor at the University of Missouri. But today, something is different. For the first time, she's being paid by a homeowners association. North lost federal funding for multiple projects last year, so now she's looking for new ways to cover the cost of research.
Currently, for the first time in my, scientific career, I have a GoFundMe or donation button on my website.
She's not alone. Science has changed dramatically in the first year of the second Trump administration, according to interviews with more than a dozen scientists in eight states, mostly in the central U.S. They laid out three big ways things have changed. The Trump administration slashed the federal scientific workforce, canceled thousands of federal research grants, and clamped down on specific subjects like climate change and environmental justice.
It's been really, really tough. I'll be honest, it's been hard and emotional, and it sometimes is really frustrating.
Bonnie Keeler is director of the Water Resources Center at the University of Minnesota. In the last year, she had three major federal grants terminated, totaling more than $14 million. They covered a range of subjects, including Mississippi River water quality and renewable energy. She says the abrupt termination of these projects wasted taxpayer money.
It's a terrible way to end a research project, given no advance warning or opportunity to meaningfully wind down the work.
But in some cases, the work will go on. Outside organizations have tried to fill gaps in the last year, including Climate Central, a U.S.-based nonprofit. Christina Dahl is the group's vice president for science.
So many key parts of the climate and weather enterprise in the federal government have been decimated.
In the last year, Climate Central hired multiple federal scientists who lost their jobs. They also started doing things the federal government used to do, like publishing a list of billion-dollar disasters and holding monthly climate briefings. But Dahl says organizations like hers won't come close to filling the void.
The reality is that even collectively, all of the U.S.-based climate and environmental nonprofits don't have the same capacity as the federal government.
Doug Kluck is one of the many former federal scientists who left their positions in the last year. After 33 years at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, he retired early because he was afraid of being fired and losing health benefits for his special needs son. But Kluck continues to host monthly climate webinars for stakeholders in the Midwest, much like he used to do at NOAA.
Although I've retired, I haven't really quit my job.
He says the last year has been a little like the Dark Ages, but he doesn't think it will last.
You can downplay climate change all you want. You can call it something else. It doesn't really matter. We're all going to be affected by it, whether we like it or not. And I'm not saying this is a belief system. This is a pure science and physics issue.
Trump spokesman Kush Desai told Harvest Public Media in a statement that the American government is the largest funder of scientific research, and the administration is, quote, committed to cutting taxpayer funding of left-wing pet projects. I'm Kate Grumke, Harvest Public Media.
A Western Illinois University professor participated in a recent UN climate change conference in Brazil. Rich Egger spoke with him about the experience and filed this report.
This was the 30th climate conference. World leaders, activists, and others get together to discuss ways to combat climate change.
Are we capable, are we wise enough as human beings to do a little bit of preventative lifeguarding and not just the reactive variety?
This is Everett Hamner. He's a professor of English at WIU, but says he's always been interdisciplinary.
I grew up going to both Space Camp and Jesus Camp, and needed to figure out how those worldviews might be potentially harmonizable.
Hamner attended seminary before earning his PhD in English. This past summer, he taught a course for the University of British Columbia on climate theology and storytelling. He says some of those involved with the climate summit got wind of his interdisciplinary interest, and that resulted in him being invited to attend the conference as an official observer. Hamner says he met a diverse array of people at the conference.
From places like Saudi Arabia, where I wouldn't have had a likely conversation before this conference, to people in Brazil, of course, people in the U.S. and Canada who are engaged internationally.
He says it was a privilege to be among people from all over the world, hold one-on-one conversations, and begin to connect with them. He says it was also beneficial to hear a variety of panelists addressing a multitude of topics. A fire broke out at the conference venue toward the end of the summit. It was brought under control quickly, but 13 people were treated for smoke inhalation. Hamner says as the scene unfolded, he witnessed an instantaneous shift from negotiating and posturing to immediate crisis management. He found it similar to what needs to be done in regard to climate change.
What has to happen is for us to be able to imagine ourselves making that shift before we're absolutely forced to, before the fire or the flood or the derecho or the whatever hits us. And not just us, but other people.
Hamner says climate change is not something that might happen in the future. It's happening now.
We're talking about the breakup of predictable climatological patterns and the increasing unreliability of a farmer's almanac.
And it's not something happening somewhere else. Its effects are being felt here, there, everywhere on the planet. He says facts and political will are needed.
I feel like those big narratives have to take account of the fact that we're all flying around literally in a spaceship Earth here, and that the life support systems are being sabotaged. Partly in ways that we're complicit with, but also by much larger structures that need our critique and attention.
Hamner says derechos, heat waves, and polar vortexes are all the result of climate destabilization. He thinks it's ecologically and economically smarter to use cleaner forms of energy and says individual solutions are increasingly accessible. But he also believes we need to avoid attacking the issue primarily as individuals. He says people should seek opportunities to act collectively and make much bigger changes.
What is my whole university doing for its power? What are our food systems in this community, and how are they intertwined with and enmeshed with the global systems that are out there?
Hamner says the climate emergency is unfolding slowly. He says that's making it a challenge to convince people to act now before it gets out of hand. Rich Egger reporting.
The structure of college classes will have to change in an AI-dominated world. That's according to Roy Magnuson, director of the newly created Adaptive Edge Institute at Illinois State University. The institute studies new technologies and how they influence teaching. Right now, that's generative AI. In an interview with Charlie Schlinker, Magnuson says it will be possible to use AI to help students gain mastery of a subject, including artificial intelligence.
You can go in and say, look, I know you could pull the lever. I know you could just have this thing write you the paper. The paper is not important. I want you to be better at writing, right? So don't do that because it's, you know, a violation of what I'm telling you to do. And there's, you know, the ramifications for that. But also you are just like, you're cutting yourself off the knees here. Like you're not getting what you need out of the class. And the point of the class is to struggle. And that's okay. Like that message needs to be there. Okay, so I say that. I have lots of colleagues who teach gen ed classes, and they have 300 students in the class. And that kind of dialogue is not necessarily possible. It's a lot easier to have that buy-in conversation with major students, you know, where you're going to see them, they see you as a mentor. If you're teaching a class of 300 students, it's much more difficult. We know this technology exists. It is not going to go away. As a university, we cannot ignore it, but that not ignoring it is not a, that shouldn't be taken as an endorsement of the tech, but we have to teach differently because the thing exists.
So how can you use AI to help the students learn how to write?
Sure. I mean, I think there are lots of strategies, right? So it can accelerate things maybe. I mean, you can look at, you know, synthesis maybe more. So you have them write and get reflexive feedback, you know, from the AI. Or, you know, have them go and take, you know, a set of, bullet points or something and have it create summaries and have them react to those things. You can have them take an idea and have the AI split it out into 10 different social media posts for 10 different things and have them critique those things like they're looking at an intern, perhaps. And then being able to speak about it, right? And that's really, I think, one of the difficult things here is assessment. Like, how do we actually assess the student's learning? And what AI is kind of doing is saying, yeah, that's all well and good, but I don't have time to do that. So like that, the assessment of grading a paper, it fits into the structure of the class and the amount of time that we give instructors. But, you know, these things can be really interesting learning outcomes and interesting ways of looking at how to teach the class, but it's antithetical to the structure of the class.
You mentioned that having AI critique some of the students' work or respond to some of the students in some way. That traditionally is something that professors do.
Mm-hmm.
So what should professors be doing instead?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is you don't want to take yourself out of the loop. I mean, that's not the university's position. It's not my position. I mean, there has to be value add for the student. It could allow us to have different interactions with students. So should professors be giving feedback on student work through like an agentic system that they're out of the loop on? My gut is no, you should be doing the evaluation. However, is there a place for immediate feedback that is monitored and scoped by the professor that allows for a faster iteration loop for the students? Probably. I mean, and in a lot of different modalities, they can do it with audio or through many languages or, you know, those tools are really powerful for that. So like I teach music theory, right? I mean, the fastest I can get them feedback is 36 hours, probably. I mean, they turn in the thing, I go, I grade it over the next day and they get their feedback. I can still do that, but couldn't they get feedback throughout the entire process too while they're doing the homework? And that is totally possible. And I think that's fine. It needs to be really clear though what the instructor is doing. It can't be, like the class has to change. It can't be that, oh, here, the system's going to grade for me, and I will change nothing else about the class. The students are going to see right through it.
Well, so how are some institutions already tackling that question? How are they changing to adapt?
Yeah, so I mean, in a lot of ways. There are places that are advertising, you know, they're, you know, all gas, no brakes, AI, we're doing this thing, we're creating digital twins of professors, and we are flipping the script entirely. There are schools, obviously, that are completely, you know, abstinent from it. Like we're just not using it. It's not part of a curriculum. I think both of those are wrong. the reality is our future is not going to be dystopia or utopia. It's going to be something that looks more like what we have today, but different. And I think our teaching needs to look like that too. You know, ISU, I think, is kind of in this middle ground.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Roy Magnuson, the head of the Adaptive Edge Institute at Illinois State University, looking at how technology interfaces with learning. What projects have you on your front burner that you want to accomplish?
Yeah, so we have a lot of things we're doing. We've set up completely on-premises secure compute. This is supported by country companies, which is great.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so it means we have some GPUs, so graphics processing units. It's the things that are powering AI, you know, in the data centers. Very, very small cluster that allows us to do completely on-premises secure. You know, if you can imagine a really simplified way, if you can access it like ChatGPT on campus at ISU, it allows us to do things like, you know, take recording data from, you know, six-year-olds at Metcalf and do transcriptions and inference on it because they want to get feedback and they want it accelerates humanities research in a way that is absolutely transformational. And that's been great.
Unpack that. What are you getting from those transcriptions? How is it helping and what's the research?
Yeah, so both at Metcalf and UHI, the idea is you can record your class as a teacher. And then, again, this sort of like paradox here is that that's more technology you're putting in between you and the students, but it allows you to be more human. So you're just recording, you're talking, you're listening to the students, you're just doing the thing. You're not thinking in your head, oh, man, how much time did I spend on that? Who's talking? Did I remember this, that student, or whatever? Because you're getting that transcript afterwards. We have a system where you can go and transcribe it securely, get the transcription, put it into a system, and then have that thing, again, whatever boundaries you want to put on this as the instructor, give you feedback. Hey, did you realize you are talking 70% of the time? Or you, three people spoke the entire class, right? Which you probably are aware of as an instructor, but you're not like documenting your head, right? So you can say, wow, okay, those three students are high. I have to make sure I need to bring in this student or this one. Oh, that was a really good point that student has. I want to make sure in the next lesson that I, you know, follow up on that. So it takes that cognitive load off and puts it on an algorithm, which allows you then as the instructor to be more human, right? You're reacting to things and your instruction gets better.
Roy Magnuson, director of the newly created Adaptive Edge Technology at Illinois State University. The institute studies new technologies and how they influence teaching. He says another effort being worked on is a set of tutoring bots for students in parallel with the class to help them stay on top of things the instructor emphasizes. Next on Statewide, the impact of a budget move several years ago in Chicago. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. There have been a variety of proposals to privatize things normally run by the government. It's been going on for a while, but a cautionary tale comes from Chicago. Nick Fountain has more.
In 2008, Chicago's mayor, Richard M. Daley, was staring down a budget shortfall and looking around for things to privatize, to bring in some cash. He decided upon the city's parking meter system. The idea was some company would give the city a big upfront lump sum payment. In exchange, they get the revenues for the parking meters for decades. When Sadek Waba, who worked at Morgan Stanley Infrastructure Partners, heard this, he was interested. So he flew to Chicago to get a lay of the land.
We rented a car and went around understanding what it meant to have a parking meter in a particular area.
You went to the Loop, you went to neighborhoods like Logan Square.
Everywhere.
Waba was trying to figure out what the future profits from all these parking meters would be, and how much he should pay for those today. He submitted a bid of $1.16 billion for 75 years of profits, and won. Well, except the city council had to approve the deal. Scott Wagasback was a young alderman at the time, and he says when it came time to vote, his colleagues didn't fully understand the deal.
One of the aldermen next to me, Dick Mell.
Thank you, Mr. President.
He actually said, how many of us read this stuff?
He stood up and he said,
how many of us read the stuff when we do get it?
That was his quote.
Okay. Let's face it.
And so I hold it up and I kind of yelled out. I was like, I read it.
All right, we've got it. I know some do and some doing it.
Wagasback voted against it, along with a handful of others, but the vast majority voted yes to sell off their parking meter system. And pretty quickly after the company took over, things went awry. meter rates went up, the private parking company didn't hire enough staff to handle all the quarters, there were protests.
The vast majority of the people reject the parking meter deal and reject Morgan Stanley's ownership of the parking meter deal.
People started stealing parking meters.
They've been grabbing these like hotcakes. I don't know who and where. I don't see how you can get away with it, you know what I mean?
And when people discovered other details of the deal, they got even more angry. The city had to reimburse the private company anytime they wanted to use a parking space for a dumpster or a street fair. And if they wanted to add a bike lane or a bus stop, something more permanent, they'd have to add paid parking spots somewhere else. But the worst of it was, Chicago's inspector general ultimately determined that the parking meter system was worth about double what the private company had paid for it. The city, in the midst of a budget crisis, had jumped at the chance to make fast cash. But they'd vastly underestimated the longer-term value of the meters to Chicago's residents.
It is the worst deal, I think, in municipal history in the United States.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely the worst deal in the history of municipalities.
And sadly for Wagasback, it's not one they can get rid of easily. The meter on this deal contractually runs out in 2084, meaning generations of Chicagoans will be cursing this one for decades to come. Nick Fountain, NPR News.
Coming up on February 5th, early voting begins for the March primary election. Congresswoman Nikki Budzinski is seeking a third term in the 13th Congressional District, which represents a large part of central Illinois. But as David Pierce reports, Budzinski faces several challengers from the GOP, as well as her own party.
Republican candidate Joshua Lloyd lives in Verdon, Illinois, near Springfield. This is his second time running in the 13th Congressional District. At the 2025 Illinois State Fair, he told me his campaign focuses on energy, education, and the economy.
Economic development within manufacturing, but we still have to focus on the farmers. Farmers are one of the most important individuals within our country.
Lloyd says Illinois is one of the top energy producers in the U.S., so he is aiming to help industries make their fuel more affordable.
Whether it's nuclear, solar, coal, natural gas, we are a top producer. So we have to make it cost-effective and efficient in order to produce and export.
Another Republican touts his 30 years of experience with nuclear energy. Champaign County Board Member Jeff Wilson gained that knowledge in the U.S. Army. I met Wilson at the state fair while campaigning with his wife, Becky. He believes nuclear energy will boost Illinois' economy.
Bringing more energy to Illinois through nuclear power, small modular reactors, so that when you turn your, when you move that light switch, your light goes on. When you want to open up the refrigerator, it's still cooling things.
Another military veteran is running on the Democratic side. We caught up with Dylan Blaha and his team as they passed out pamphlets to students at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. The Urbana resident is an Army vet who served in Afghanistan and performed cancer research from 2017 to 2021 as a U of I student. He wants to focus on basic needs if elected to Congress.
Affordable housing. There is a rising unhoused crisis in everywhere from Champaign-Urbana to Springfield to East St. Louis. And so building affordable housing and investing in infrastructure all around towns. There's a lot of young people that are 20, 30, even in their 40s that they just don't feel like they can afford housing anymore.
Blaha is trying to unseat Democratic incumbent Nikki Budzinski, who is running for a third time to represent the 13th Congressional District. During her time in office, Congresswoman Budzinski helped the Village of Savoy secure more than $22 million for an infrastructure project that will build a new bridge on Curtis Road so trains can pass over cars, improving travel times. Congresswoman Budzinski told me she wants to continue focusing on economic policies in her next term.
The first is called the LEAP Act, which again connects to my workforce development work. It's a tax credit for small businesses that hire apprentices, again helping to make more opportunities a reality for young people that want to get into the workplace here in central Illinois.
Budzinski, a former aide for Governor J.B. Pritzker and former President Joe Biden, also supports repealing parts of President Trump's Big Beautiful Bill that would reduce reimbursements to Medicaid. Also entering the race is Democratic challenger Dr. Emily Lux, a graduate of the U of I and former law consultant to faculty and students on social work issues. She hopes to create legislation on how officers and mental health specialists can work together to support families.
The police are one of the first things that the child sees. And the separation of the family is one of the first things that happen under the authority of the police. And I think that having them hold back for a little bit until everything is explained, everything has been talked about, and then having them enter, I think will be a much more productive and gentler approach for the child.
The Illinois primary will be held on Tuesday, March 17th. The winners will compete in the general election in November and will help determine if the next U.S. Congress will be majority Democratic or Republican. I'm David Pierce reporting.
The Safe Schools for All Act is one of many new Illinois laws that went into effect January 1st. Democratic State Senator Corina Villa sponsored the legislation. Peter Medlin spoke with her about what the new law does.
This new law is meant to ensure kids aren't denied a free public education based on immigration status, but how exactly does the law try to do that?
These requirements include that there's a process for reviewing and contacting a designated authorized person at the school or school facility who may contact the school's legal counsel if ICE were to show up to the building. Also, the process for authorized persons or legal counsel to review requests to enter a school or school facility, including judicial warrants, non-judicial warrants, and subpoenas. These are all technical words, but let's just play it out. Before the law, if ICE were to come into the school, you might have someone at the front office who's frazzled when they see someone in uniform. They call the student down, or they start going through the files without knowing that maybe what they're doing is harmful for the student because there's no procedure in place.
Have we seen that over the past year at schools who haven't had these protocols and procedures in place?
I don't know of any documented cases. However, with the increased presence of ICE, we needed to make sure families and students knew that there's policy and procedure on the books.
You know, I've had conversations with school leaders about this and about immigration over the past couple of years. I've had several leaders tell me, like, we don't have any student immigration status information. Like, we just don't collect that information. Are there certain situations where schools, you know, do have that information about student immigration status?
You know, picture a school district where you have a family that's lived in town for 15 years. Whether or not it's formally spoken, there are often times that people know information about each other. I could see how in passing there could be informally collected information in files unbeknownst to the person at the front office. Maybe something in a student's IEP plan.
The Supreme Court ruled back in, I think, the early 80s, right, that schools can't deny kids an education based on this. And so is it fair to say that one of the big reasons also for this legislation is, again, enshrining these protections at the state level in case there were to be a challenge to that precedent federally?
Yes, 100%.
Another part of this is if a school district violates this law, families can bring a civil lawsuit against the school. Why was that an important piece to include in the legislation?
A lot of times that there's legislation that is passed that doesn't offer much in terms of remedies if something is not followed. And this isn't just the school district didn't follow something. It's that there was complete negligence, and it was almost a sinister act of handing over information.
I've heard anecdotally about families who, especially at the beginning of last year, were really afraid to send their kids to school at all, and schools have tried to reassure them that it is a safe place to go, and there have been schools like West Chicago, where you're from, who've had staff walk kids home from school and things like that. Are there any families or community members you've heard from recently who are still feeling afraid to send their kids to school or to community organizations?
There are schools in our communities who immediately already put these policies and procedures in place even before the law was passed. And there have been communities where maybe the percentage of immigrant students is much less. And so it might not be at the top of mind for those schools. It's those school districts where I am getting the calls from that the families are still very concerned about sending their children to school. Those are the school districts that policies such as this are so critical.
That's State Senator Corina Villa talking about the new Safe Schools for All Act. She spoke with Peter Medlin. Across the U.S., lawmakers have introduced hundreds of bills that limit gender-affirming care and limiting transgender people from public life. It's causing some to leave their homes in search of safer and more affirming communities. Sam Rink has the story of one person who's chosen Central Illinois as their destination. A note to listeners, this story briefly mentions sexual violence.
Aaron Slayton lives and works at five-acre farm Daylilies a few miles outside Tolono with their husband, Jim Wersch. On this unseasonably warm November day, they take advantage of the weather to get some work done on the farm where they hope to install new sheds and fencing before next spring.
But what I'm working on over in this area and across here will be where new fencing will go.
Aaron initially came to Illinois from Tennessee this past January to help Jim deal with the grief of losing his late husband, Rod Cromer. And what was meant to be a short visit turned into a permanent move.
I technically never went back home after coming down.
Aaron is non-binary, and they say part of their decision to stay came from an increase in discrimination they experienced while living in Lebanon, Tennessee. A few years ago, they were raped and contracted HIV, which progressed into AIDS, but they weren't welcome at gendered support groups for victims of sexual violence. They were also turned away from food pantries operated by some Christian churches, and they were even harassed at a restaurant they frequented in Nashville.
There were a lot of times that I just didn't feel safe, so I kind of quit going.
They say the Trump administration's rhetoric has emboldened people to harass trans people in public.
They don't think that it is discrimination to blatantly say transphobic things. And so there were places in public settings where if somebody recognized me as being trans, it was putting me in danger because they felt a need to throw me out of whatever public place I was in because I didn't belong, because somehow I was a threat.
A recent survey conducted by the Williams Institute, a think tank at the UCLA School of Law, suggests Aaron's experience isn't uncommon. Almost half of transgender, non-binary, and gender-diverse U.S. adults say they'd considered moving or had already moved to a more trans-affirming place. But it can be even harder for children and teens who are trans because of tighter restrictions in many states. And Illinois has become a target destination for some of their families as one of four Midwestern states that has not banned gender-affirming care for minors. Asher McMaher is executive director of Trans Upfront Illinois, a nonprofit that advocates for trans people from ages 4 to 25.
Our organization serves anyone in the state or anyone who comes into the state to access care. Right now, we serve about 900 families. About 250 of those are from surrounding states.
They say parents are worried about their children's safety
and their ability and access to get health care, because we know gender-affirming care is life-saving. And they're worried that they're going to lose their child.
But even in a state with trans-affirming laws, federal orders can still make it difficult for people here, especially minors, to access certain kinds of care. Joshua Gavel is the executive director of Uniting Pride of Champaign County.
It's really scary right now, the stuff that they're doing at the federal level to specifically go after hospitals and threaten millions of dollars in funding and needed funding, especially for like rural hospitals.
Just this February, Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago announced it would pause gender care surgeries for people under 19 after threats to funding from the Trump administration. And Gavel says with care getting more difficult to access,
it's a tough situation, and I think we're going to see families making hard choices for a while.
But he says healthcare isn't the only thing that draws trans people to the state.
In this community, especially Champaign-Urbana, like proper, there are so many affirming partners here.
He says the schools are a big motivation, and it's no secret Champaign-Urbana is more affordable than a major city like Chicago. Gavel also says queer-friendly faith spaces have drawn people to the area, including the Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign, where Aaron and Jim volunteer almost every Sunday.
It has really helped me to be able to sort of act as a segue into the wider community.
The UU Church in Urbana is a trans-affirming congregation that regularly participates in protests, pride events, and has social justice as one of its 8 core principles of belief. Here, Aaron is free to openly identify as non-binary and express their gender as well as practice their pagan beliefs in community with others. They say what the church offers is more than just empty words.
What will make a difference and what will impact people is knowing that they have a community that actually cares about them.
I'm Sam Rink, IPM News.
Ahead, we hear from a man who spent more than 3 decades behind bars in the state of Illinois for a crime he did not commit. That's ahead on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. There were no fatal shootings on Illinois interstate highways last year. Mawa Iqbal has more on that story.
It's been roughly 10 years since the number of interstate shooting fatalities was that low, according to the Illinois State Police. The agency reports a 31% decrease in general interstate shootings from 2024. And since a post-pandemic spike in 2021, shootings have dropped considerably year after year. Last year saw 61 shootings. State Police Director Brendan Kelly, in a statement, says he owes the lower numbers to the agency's air operations that help track drivers fleeing from officers, reducing the risk of a high-speed pursuit. Kelly says, quote, "As crime evolves, so will we in order to keep our community safe." I'm Mawa Iqbal.
In November, a man who spent 32 years in prison for a crime he did not commit became a free man. Danny Davis was exonerated with help from the Illinois Innocence Project based at the University of Illinois Springfield. Davis was convicted of stabbing a woman to death in her Caro home in 1992. He was 20 at the time and was taken into custody and questioned along with his brother. Davis said police coerced confessions through physical and psychological abuse. DNA evidence later proved their innocence. His brother Isaac was previously released. Now 52, Danny Davis and his legal team speak about the experience with reporter Evan Holden.
My name is Maria De Arteaga, and I'm a senior staff attorney at the Illinois Innocence Project, and I was one of the attorneys working on Danny Davis's case.
And I'm Lauren Caseberg, legal director at the Illinois Innocence Project. We have worked on Danny's case for a decade now. We opened his case in 2015 and have now been able to see him be exonerated. But it took 10 years.
Yes. My name is Danny Davis, and I'm the one who's been exonerated.
Yay.
Talk about your story from being in prison to now being exonerated and then where both of you came in.
Well, in 2015, an inmate told me to write the Innocent Project, and I did that. But fortunately, they did take my case, and I sent them all the paperwork when they asked for it, and then they started going to work for it, like investigating my case and seeing that the flaws in my case and that I was actually innocent of the crime. And now they did the DNA test in my case, and now it shows that I'm actually innocent of the crime. And I've been exonerated on November the 12th. The charge has been filed to dismiss it due to the fact that the DNA don't match. Me or my co-defendant or other co-defendant is my brother Isaac Davis. You know, we all three was innocent of this crime.
Yeah, all three were charged with the murder of a woman in Caro, Illinois. And what Danny is talking about with respect to the DNA is that DNA that was taken from fingernails of the victim excluded Danny, Isaac, and DeVoe Johnson.
This is really an outrageous case where you had a horrific murder of a woman in her own home. The police had an opportunity to get it right at the time and solve that case and put the right person behind bars, but they didn't do that. And instead, they arrested Danny, his brother, and an acquaintance of theirs. At the time, the police coerced false confessions from Danny and his brother. They used their vulnerabilities against them. They pitted each other. It made Danny feel like he had to save Isaac, and Isaac make like he had to save Danny. Got false confessions from both of them. Danny was charged with capital murder, facing the death penalty. And the prosecutor took him in a room in the courthouse before a trial and said, if you don't plead guilty to this case, you're going to get convicted and you'll be dead within 30 days, which was not true. I mean, he doesn't know what's going to happen to the trial, first of all, and used this horrendous threat of his own death within 30 days against him, coerced him to plead guilty to a crime he did not commit. And so him and his brother pled guilty in front of a judge. The evidence against them was barely existent, but for this false confession. The judge accepted their guilty pleas, sentenced Danny to life in prison without parole. The third person who was charged actually went to trial and fought the case. There was no, he did not confess. And so he thought he had a chance at trial, which was a bench trial, which means a trial without a jury in front of a judge, in front of the very same judge who had just sentenced Danny to life in prison. And he acquitted that third person, who was found not guilty because the confessions were not reliable evidence to use to convict him. And no one ever did anything about that. So for decades, Danny and his brother have maintained, have told every person who would listen, I'm innocent, I did not commit this crime. When he entered his guilty plea, he said to the judge, I'm only doing this to save my life. Yeah. Judge didn't listen. The prosecutor didn't listen. No one listened. And it took Danny and his persistence. He's very modest, but, you know, fighting and surviving all those years in prison and finding the courage to keep going every day. And finally, we were able to hear those pleas and accept his case. And we're so grateful that it took us a long time. It took us a decade to get there of, you know, arguing different things, doing all this testing, but ultimately being exonerated.
Can you talk a little bit more about your persistence when it came to your innocence?
I just never gave up. I just kept on fighting. A lot of guys in there just be like, well, you got natural life, it's over with, this your home, give up. I was like, no, this is not my home. I didn't do it. I'm gonna keep fighting. My mother passed, and I told her before she passed, I said, I would keep fighting to my last breath. And that's what I've done. And that gave me hope to keep fighting. When people say you can't do it, I say I can. I knew I was being railroaded into the prison system. I never gave up. And I thank the Innocence Project, the Exoneration Project, for believing in me, and taking my case, and fighting my case, and winning my case. If it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be standing here today, period.
Can you talk about the process of finally getting exonerated?
So after Danny wrote into the Innocence Project New York and the Illinois Innocence Project, and the two projects jointly took his case, the first thing that was done was preparing a motion for DNA testing. There were definitely some issues with that. I think you could probably talk more about the they couldn't find evidence and had to the clerk's office claimed that the evidence was missing. And eventually, after court orders to continue that search to find the evidence, they were able to find that fingernail evidence had been preserved. And so that evidence was tested. And while that was happening and after, the team continued to actively investigate the case and also get a false confession expert involved with the case. And there, through investigation and a lot of document requests, the team discovered that there was a lot of important information that was never turned over to Danny or his defense team pre-trial, including some really important 911 call records and a lot of information that would have been incredibly helpful in identifying really the true perpetrator or alternate suspects. And so after gathering all that information and undertaking that investigation combined with these results of the DNA testing from those fingernails that eliminated Danny and his co-defendants, and this was a crime scene where it was very clear that there was a main struggle, so fingernails are really important pieces of DNA evidence in those types of cases. The next step then was filing a motion in court to vacate Danny's conviction, which resulted in getting an evidentiary hearing where we got an opportunity to present all this evidence to a judge. And that judge heard that evidence and agreed that Danny's conviction should be vacated. On November 8th, he walked out of prison a free man. And it just so happened, a year to the day, finally the state dismissed the case and decided not to move forward with retrying him or trying him. And it was, we were so happy for Danny.
Can you talk on how it feels to be exonerated?
Oh, shoot, I was jumping over the roof. I was jumping over the roof. It's just like a weight off my shoulder, weight off my family's shoulder. Because when you go into there, you're just not doing the time yourself. Your family doing it along with you. When I got exonerated, they got exonerated. Now I just enjoy them. And I don't take them for granted, or nothing that I do for granted. And I definitely don't take these guys, you know, for granted. I don't take them for granted. I thank them. I am grateful to them. But yeah, I, like I say, man, I just enjoy life. Laughter, fun, just go about my day. Because I think about those days, like when I was in that cell, like, man, you couldn't do this. You couldn't go to outside when you wanted to. Now I could go outside. I just enjoy it because I have it now.
I think one of the hardest parts about doing this work is that we know that there are thousands of people who are innocent who won't be exonerated. We get hundreds of letters every year from people asking us to look at their case and pleading their innocence. And we take as many cases as we can. We work really hard to try to exonerate and obtain freedom for as many innocent people as we can. But we know that there are thousands of people in jails and prisons in Illinois who didn't do what they're there for. When we have the ability to celebrate a big victory like this and be able to bring somebody freedom and bring them exoneration, we really do try to celebrate that and soak it in. On the occasions when someone like Danny gets out of prison and then is exonerated around the time of the holidays, it has such a special feeling. The holidays are so difficult for incarcerated people and their families. He texts us almost every morning and says, good morning. Yes. And it's such a beautiful thing to receive. And we joke sometimes and say, like, one of the best things is being able to put our clients' phone numbers in our phones when they are free and they get their own cell phone for the first time ever. Because even, like, we work on these cases for years, and in Danny's case for a decade, every time we were able to communicate with him had to be pre-scheduled, arranged, or setting up legal calls, you're setting up visits, you're driving 6 hours down to Menard to do a visit, you're driving to these various correctional facilities around the state, and there's never the ability to just have them reach out to us when they need us or spontaneously talk to them. So there's freedom just in that, of the things that you forget, you do take for granted every day. You can pick up the phone and call the person that you want to talk to. You can reach out to them and you can talk privately.
What are your future goals?
Spend time with my family, travel, and let my lawyers just deal with all the legal stuff. I don't want to. Just go live my life and have fun with my family. Can't think about the past, it's gone. So you got to go forth. Can't be bitter. You just got to be accept what you got now. And be happy and thankful. Number one thing is I never forgot God. I always kept God first in everything that I did.
Are there any future goals legally or waiting right now?
I mean, I think at some point, you know, Danny deserves that certificate of innocence. I mean, he's been exonerated. A certificate of innocence in the state of Illinois entitles you to some compensation. Currently, the amount of compensation that a person is entitled to is capped at a certain amount. It's around $280,000, no matter how much time you did in prison. That falls woefully short of anything that's at all respectable, but also falls short of the federal national standard of what people should be getting. The Illinois Innocence Project has been championing legislation for a couple years now. We're really hopeful that in the spring session, we will be able to pass legislation that would bring the amount of compensation that a person is entitled to $50,000 a year for each year they were incarcerated. For someone in Danny's position who was in prison for over 30 years, what he would currently get under that framework is around $6,000 a year for every year that he was in prison. Compensation is really restitution. It's the state making something as right as they can. It's not about anything but that the state got this horribly wrong. They took time from him. They took him away from his family. They took him away from us and all the things we could, you know, society could have benefited from. And he deserves to have some amount of restoration, just like any other innocent person. So the goal of a certificate of innocence is really, it includes that. But I think it's also just the restoration of someone's name. The same court that you were convicted in, when you get that piece of paper that declares you were innocent, is really meaningful to people. There are cases actually ongoing right now in the state of Illinois where people have been through their entire court process. They've even had like civil cases that have been resolved, and they're still fighting to get that certificate of innocence. It's not about the money, it's about getting your name back.
Danny Davis was released from prison in November. He served 32 years for a crime he did not commit. He and his legal team from the Illinois Innocence Project, Maria de Arteaga, and Lauren Caseberg spoke with Evan Holden. That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. Join us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois public radio stations.